I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's May 24th, and we have a lot to talk about. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about the twists and turns that often pop up on the road to getting diagnosed with MS. Think about how much easier, cheaper, and less invasive it would be if you could be diagnosed by getting a simple blood test. Well, the good news is that we're a lot closer to that moment than you may think. Scientists have identified biomarkers that will simplify diagnosing MS, and other biomarkers that have the potential to predict MS before anyone experiences any symptoms. And biomarkers have been identified that may help neurologists see future MS progression before it occurs. These are big changes that will have a significant impact on diagnosing and treating multiple sclerosis. Biomarkers will even impact the way that MS clinical trials are designed. Joining me today to take us through a crash course in biomarkers and MS, and to help us understand how close we may be to seeing all of this come about, is Dr. Tanuja Chitnis. Dr. Chitnis is a professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School, as well as the director of the CLIMB study and the Translational Neuroimmunology Research Center at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Tanuja Chitnis, there are a few other things that you should know about. May 30th is World MS Day, the day that the global MS community comes together to share our stories and raise awareness about MS. This year, the theme of World MS Day is I Connect, We Connect. And that theme speaks to the different types of connections we can each make. Like making connections that challenge the social barriers that leave people living with MS feeling isolated. Or connecting with our legislators through our advocacy efforts to ensure that people living with MS have access to quality, affordable healthcare and affordable MS medications. And perhaps the most important connection we can make, and that's with each other. I think that someone living with MS feels most seen, heard, and understood when they connect with someone who really gets it, someone else who's living with MS. And I could say the same thing about MS caregivers. It's like we already know the secret handshake. So make those connections, because we also know that together we are stronger. If you're looking for ways to participate in World MS Day, or you're interested in seeing how other members of the global MS community are participating, be sure to visit worldmsday.org, and you'll find that link in today's show notes. A few weeks ago, I remember saying that we were going to start hearing more about research that's focused on myelin repair. And it seems like ever since I said those words, I found myself sharing encouraging news about remyelination research in every single podcast episode. And today's episode is no exception. Autobahn Therapeutics has reported that ABX-002, its experimental treatment for MS, has effectively promoted remyelination in preclinical models of MS. This week, Professor Ian Duncan, a past guest on the podcast and one of the leading experts in the world on the subject of myelin repair, is presenting research showing that one of Autobahn Therapeutics' lab-made molecules was successful in promoting myelin repair in an animal model of MS. Now, just as a quick review, myelin is the fatty sheath that protects nerve fibers in our central nervous system. MS damages myelin, making it difficult for these nerves to send messages to other parts of the body, and that leads to loss of function or disability. Myelin repair restores that lost function. And while there's an enormous amount of work yet to be done here, we're hearing encouraging news about some of these efforts that are already well underway. This is clearly a subject that we'll be hearing more about as science continues to advance. Another subject that we've talked about in previous podcast episodes is the value and importance of getting your information about MS from credible, reliable sources. This is a growing area of concern, especially as the practice of medicine is transitioning to a shared decision-making model. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality defines shared decision-making as a process in which, and I'm quoting now, a healthcare provider and a patient work together to make a healthcare decision that is best for the patient. The optimal decision takes into account evidence-based information about available options, the provider's knowledge and experience, and the patient's values and preferences. Shared decision-making makes you a partner, a full participant in your treatment plan. And if you're going to be a good partner, a well-informed partner, you'll want to do some homework. So the question becomes, where do you get your health information from? For years, I know doctors have cringed at the thought that their patients were consulting with Dr. Google. But if doctors cringed when they thought about Dr. Google, their hearts may actually skip a few beats when they discover that their patients are often consulting social media. Just last week, I came across this tweet posted on Twitter. Now, the tweet is from someone in the UK. We'll keep them anonymous, but I'm going to directly quote this tweet in its entirety. I had my first call with my MS nurse. I'm stuck choosing between Tysabri, Ocrevus, Mavenclad, or Lemtrada. Can anyone give me any personal insights on their experiences? Thank you. Now, one thing we know about MS medications is, just like MS, they can affect different people differently. So while it's interesting to learn what others have experienced, it's certainly not a reasonable basis for making a decision about your own health and well-being. You'd be basing that decision on how a particular medication may or may not have impacted someone else. Someone whose MS may be at a very different stage than yours. Someone who may be living with comorbidities that you don't have. Someone who may be many years older or many years younger than you. And all of these things will influence that person's experience with that particular MS medication. But they may have nothing to do with your experience. We've seen this same scenario play out much more tragically over the past 2 years, as people have made decisions about whether or not to receive the COVID-19 vaccine. Too many people have based their decision on what can only be described as bad information on social media. Sometimes it's misinformation and sometimes it's disinformation. But most, if not all, of those poor decisions were made, I'm sure, with the very best of intentions. And they've resulted in thousands of unnecessary deaths. How many times have we seen images in the media of people hospitalized with very serious COVID symptoms saying, or I should say gasping, that they thought they were doing the right thing by refusing that vaccination, and now, when it was clearly too late, they've come to realize the absolute reality that they're facing. So we've all witnessed how this issue of finding credible health information online can become a real matter of life and death. That's why last year, the National Academy of Medicine launched a project to help identify principles for identifying credible sources of health information in social media. The initial goal of the project was to enhance public access to evidence-based health information during the COVID-19 pandemic, but this issue has relevance that goes well beyond the pandemic itself. The National Academy of Medicine assembled an independent expert advisory group that included experts in information governance, health information development, public health and health equity, social media and misinformation, and science communication. And in conducting their work, this group presented a public webinar, followed by a public comment period, as well as pursuing other information gathering activities. And now they've published a detailed report, which is a great first step. But admittedly, this is a huge challenge. As everyone has probably experienced at one time or another, The individuals and entities that spread some of the biggest lies online also tend to shout the loudest. So it's no easy task finding credible and reliable sources of evidence-based health information. Now, when it comes to curating the best information about multiple sclerosis, my recommendation is to start with the National MS Society. There isn't another organization with the MS Society's level of expertise or track record as the largest private funder of MS research in the world. Now, this subject of being able to identify credible sources of health information, I think it resonates so clearly and so loudly with me because my work involves sharing information about MS with thousands of you every week. And that's why I go out of my way to share my sources so that you can review the details of the research. Or at the very least, you know that I've reviewed those details. But managing the amount of misinformation and disinformation available through social media while still protecting everyone's right of free speech is a monumentally complex challenge. And I appreciate the effort undertaken by the National Academy of Medicine to shine a bright light and raise awareness of a problem that won't go away on its own. If you'd like to review the report that the National Academy of Medicine's Expert Advisory Group has published, you'll find that link in today's show notes. If you're a caregiver for someone living with MS, or if you're a healthcare provider who interacts with MS caregivers, or if you're a researcher who focuses their work on MS caregivers or who might like to explore MS caregiver research, iConquer MS, the people-powered MS research network, wants to hear from you. Now, iConquer MS is a virtual research community for people affected by MS. It currently has over 8,000 members, the majority of whom are people living with multiple sclerosis. And now, iConquer MS has plans to expand its participant community to include MS caregivers themselves. Full disclosure, I'm serving as the co-lead in this project, and we want to make sure that we capture feedback from MS caregivers, researchers, and healthcare providers as we design and implement support for MS caregivers and for MS caregiver research within iConquer MS. That's why your opinion is so important. And it would mean a lot to me if you'd share your opinion with us. So if you're an MS caregiver, researcher, or healthcare provider who interacts with MS caregivers, I hope you'll invest just 10 minutes of your time to complete an important online survey. You'll find the appropriate links to that survey for caregivers, healthcare providers, and researchers in today's show notes. People living with MS and their caregivers know that getting an MS diagnosis involves invasive, expensive, and time-consuming procedures. In a moment, we'll be joined by my guest, Dr. Tanuja Chitnis, and we'll learn about the work her lab has been doing in identifying biomarkers that can potentially change how MS is diagnosed, give doctors a way to predict MS before symptoms develop, and even see future MS progression. If you're a regular listener, you've heard me talk about biomarkers fairly often. Biomarkers can be extremely useful in diagnosing, tracking, and predicting the course of MS. They can help your neurologist understand when MS has transitioned from a relapsing form to a more progressive form, and they can potentially play a role in shortening clinical trials. Joining me today to explain the importance of biomarkers in MS and tell us about new research that could impact future MS treatment is Dr. Tanuja Chitnis. Dr. Chitnis is a professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School, as well as a director of the CLIMB study and the Translational Neuroimmunology Research Center at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Chitnis.
It's a pleasure to be here, John.
Let's start with the definition. Can you tell us what a biomarker is? And maybe you can share some examples of biomarkers that are used every day in clinical practice.
So, John, great question. So biomarkers are any measurable substance or measure that reflects a biological or medical disease process or disease state. And some examples of biomarkers that we typically use in clinical practice are blood pressure. So you may go to your doctor and blood pressures will reflect your cardiovascular state. Other biomarkers that are commonly used include blood glucose or blood sugar levels, and this reflects whether you might be at a pre-diabetic or diabetic level. And another biomarker to monitor diabetes is called hemoglobin A1C, and that level could tell you how well your diabetes is being controlled.
Now, the biomarkers that are used in MS can be classified into four categories: predictive biomarkers, diagnostic biomarkers, disease activity biomarkers, and treatment response biomarkers. So let's talk about each of these. Now, predictive biomarkers could help potentially identify individuals at risk of developing MS. This seems like something that would be really valuable for family members of someone who's living with multiple sclerosis. Could a predictive biomarker actually identify MS before any MS symptoms develop?
So, John, that's a very important question and an area of active research now. What we've learned over the past 20 or so years are that there are certain genes that predispose individuals to having MS, and ostensibly those genes could be measured, and we could identify those who might be genetically at risk for having MS. What we've also learned over the past many years now is that certain viruses, including Epstein-Barr virus, predisposes people to developing MS shortly after exposure. And so demonstrating levels of antibodies to Epstein-Barr is also another biomarker indicating someone who may be at risk for multiple sclerosis.
Are we at a point where predictive biomarkers are being used?
So I think we are not quite there yet. The challenge is that these biomarkers are very common. The ones that I mentioned, certain genes or having exposure to Epstein-Barr virus, occurs in many people. What we do need are more specific biomarkers that indicate that the MS process has started, maybe before clinical symptoms have started. And these might be measurable in people who are at risk, either through family history or genetically, for having multiple sclerosis. So I think we're hopefully going to be there soon, but we're still not quite there.
The second category of biomarkers that I mentioned a moment ago was diagnostic biomarkers. And these biomarkers are used to confirm that someone has MS. What types of biomarkers are used as diagnostic biomarkers?
So, John, we use MRI as a diagnostic biomarker for multiple sclerosis very frequently. So a diagnosis of MS, as many people may know, is based on a couple of things. One is clinical symptoms or attacks. The second is the MRI picture and the types of lesions that are present on MRI. We also need to show that there's been a change over time, and either the presence of certain types of lesions or accumulation of new lesions will indicate that the MS process has started and we can diagnose MS. Another biomarker that's used in diagnosis are oligoclonal bands, and these are basically antibodies that are measured in the spinal fluid of people, and this is something that helps to confirm a diagnosis of MS but does require a lumbar puncture.
I think the question on the minds of many of our listeners is, if we have these diagnostic biomarkers, why can it sometimes be challenging to get an MS diagnosis?
The challenge, John, is that there are many other disorders that can look a lot like MS, especially on the MRI picture. And we're very careful to distinguish and differentiate between other mimics or similar conditions. And also, sometimes we need to show a change in time, showing that there has been accumulation or increase in the number of lesions. And this might be challenging to show in people who have a one-time MRI that just shows a picture that looks like MS. So we do need to monitor and show that these MRIs are changing in order to confirm a diagnosis.
Now, treatment response biomarkers are measured in people receiving a disease-modifying therapy to determine whether the treatment is working. Are these treatment response biomarkers currently being used? And if they are, how are they measured?
So there are a couple of treatment response biomarkers. One very common one are B-cell levels in people who are treated with B-cell antibodies or B-cell depleting agents. And this could include treatments such as ocrelizumab, rituximab, ofatumumab, and other antibodies that get rid of B-cells. And so typically we make sure that these therapies are working by measuring CD19 and CD20 counts, which are proteins present on the surface of B cells. And if those counts are zero, then we know that the therapy should be doing its thing and we have the right dose.
And final category, disease activity biomarkers. Now, these are biomarkers that can help distinguish relapsing remitting MS from secondary progressive MS. What types of biomarkers are used for this and how are they measured?
So John, this is a really exciting area that's developing. And one of the disease activity biomarkers that has had a lot of attention and research recently done is called neurofilament light chain. So neurofilament light chain is a component of neurons or axons, the tail of neurons, which are of course present in one's brain. And these can be under attack with an MS lesion. And neurofilament light chain is increased at the time of an attack, and it can be detected both in the spinal fluid as well as in the blood or in the serum. And neurofilament light chain, or I'll call them NFL levels for short, are somewhat elevated around the time of a new gadolinium-enhancing lesion, which may or may not be associated with a relapse or clinical symptoms.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned neurofilament light chain. It's certainly been receiving a tremendous amount of focus and attention from the research community. How is a neurofilament light chain level measured in someone with MS? Does it require special tools?
Yeah, so the NFL levels or neurofilament light chain can be measured using just blood samples, which is really exciting because these are accessible and they can be done in many different parts of the country or the world. And so a typical blood sample can be run on what's called a proteomic assay or test. And the advance that has been really important in the past few years is that we now have very sensitive proteomic assays that can measure very minute levels of these types of proteins, including NFL. And this can be measured in the blood. And we know that it seems to reflect disease activity or relapses and a relapsing disease course.
When I introduced you, I reminded our listeners that you're the director of the Comprehensive Longitudinal Investigation in MS at Brigham and Women's Hospital, also known as the CLIMB study. You and your team have been studying NFL levels in people with MS for several years now. What have you learned so far from your research?
Thanks for that question, John. So we have seen that NFL levels are elevated around the time of an attack or new gadolinium-enhancing lesion. We've also seen, along with others, that on treatments, the NFL levels tend to decrease. So that is very good news, and that probably indicates that disease activity has reduced on certain treatments. And we're also evaluating the value of NFL levels in prognosticating long-term outcomes. And we found that NFL levels measured around the time of a first visit or first presentation can help to predict longer-term brain lesion volume and brain atrophy in the future. So if we, in the future, possibly if we see high NFL levels at the time of a first visit, that will help us to select appropriate treatments for patients who might be at higher risk for worse outcomes.
The International Progressive MS Alliance has recommended advancing research on neurofilament light chain as a specific biomarker for MS progression. How might this impact future clinical trials?
So I think that's a really interesting question. The value of NFL is also that it can help to predict disability in the future. And this might be disability such as developing progressive MS or having progression. There are probably other biomarkers that help to predict or are associated with progressive MS. And along with NFL, these biomarkers may help to identify patients who would better fit into trials for progressive MS treatments. And if we can select the right population of people who are more likely to respond to certain treatments using biomarkers, then we might have a better chance for successful outcomes.
The annual meeting of the Americas Committee for the Treatment and Research in MS, also known as the ACTRIMS Forum, took place this past February. And the theme of that meeting was biomarkers. I was at that meeting, and I heard you and your colleagues present findings validating the MS disease activity test developed by Octave Bioscience. Can you tell us about that project and what your findings could mean for the future of MS care?
Yeah, so this is a very exciting project I've been involved in for a few years. And as I had mentioned previously, we know that neurofilament light chain or NFL levels are elevated around the time of a new attack or new lesion forming. But we wondered whether additional proteins could help identify or increase the sensitivity for detecting those attacks. And so we surveyed around 1,000 proteins and came up with a short list of about 20 proteins that, along with NFL, increase the sensitivity to detect an attack when it was occurring. And so we have studied that that set of biomarkers now in a number of different groups of samples. So, of course, once you make a discovery, you have to validate it or confirm it in other groups of samples and make sure that it's valid across different patient populations and types. And at the ACTRIMS meeting, we were able to present results in over 600 patients showing that this biomarker signature was associated with new disease activity.
Everything we've been talking about sounds really promising. So when it comes to actually treating patients in the clinic, how close are we to implementing new biomarkers that are going to help detect and possibly prevent MS before symptoms appear, track the course of disease progression, and monitor response to therapy in order to deliver personalized treatment? Where are we?
So John, I think we're very close, and it's very exciting to be a neurologist practicing in this time, because I think that biomarkers can help neurologists and patients to monitor their disease course, response to treatment, and also predict longer-term disease outcomes. And the steps now are, now that we have a lot of studies that have been run and validated in different groups of patients, the challenge is now rolling out these biomarker tests to become available, also accepted by regulatory agencies or local authorities and hospitals, and also helping neurologists and patients understand the outcomes of those biomarker tests and interpreting them appropriately.
Well, Dr. Tanusha Chitness, thank you for all you do in the laboratory and the clinic to improve the lives of people living with MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
It's been my pleasure, John.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/247. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes, and it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.